From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan.
And a very warm welcome aboard the pirate ship, the Reeve Gauche, into the Captain's Table podcast, brought to you by Are You Not Entertained? I'm Giles Morgan. I'm not actually a captain.
I'm the captain.
Or indeed a pirate. But a vague ancestor of my family, Captain Henry Morgan, actually was one, and his family all came from Wales as well. This is a 30-minute romp of a podcast, where each week I simply ask my special guests to share their own personal memories of being a sports fan, and how that passion has affected and shaped their lives.
Well, ahoy there, landlubbers. It's Captain Morgan here, back on my majestic poop deck, which is, you'll be pleased to know, virus-free. And what a few weeks it's been since we last met. All sorts of things going on in the world, but I've been safe from it, bobbing up and down on my schooner. Leanne, my Australian parrot, has been out of sorts. She generally doesn't like people very much and has found the endless stream of guests a little upsetting. She is on her last warming and she may have to go back to her cage. Also, my hugely incompetent steward, Paul, he's having a shocker. He's messed up all of the drinks so far and again, he's soon to walk the plank. Anyway, enough about the crew. I hope you're ready to welcome another guest to the captain's table. As soon as I heard who was coming on this show, I'm afraid we had to change all our plans and plot a course back to England, which meant we had to get rid of Jonathan Davis, and we were able to tip him overboard shortly after leaving Swansea Bay, so we did not have to schlep all the way over to Vancouver. So since then, we've sailed up the Irish Sea as far as Liverpool and then headed inland a bit to Audley Edge to press gang the one and only Sir Chris Hoy. Now, Chris is the first of a number of knights of the realm who are coming on the show in the weeks ahead. But of all my shining knights, he is undoubtedly the fittest and the most presentable in Lycra. As British sporting heroes go, he is right in the middle of the pantheon. A 6 times Olympic gold medalist and 11 times world champion. He is the most successful Olympic cyclist of all time. Since 2013, Chris has swapped 2 wheels for 4 wheels and is now an accomplished racing car driver, as well as hugely involved with his bike brand, Hoy Bikes. A very warm welcome to the Captain's Table, Sir Chris Hoy.
Thank you.
Well, pull up a chair, make yourself at home. I've sailed the Reeve Gauche quite close to here. We're a little bit inland.
Yeah, yeah.
I then trudged through the mud to get here. It's been a windy day. It's good to see you. You're looking very well, as always. And take a seat and make yourself at home.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, firstly, we've got to get you a drink. And as you know, on the Reeve Gauche, we only really have rum. Captain Morgan's rum, brilliantly. And it's a pirate ship, so it's quite scant, the sort of stuff we have on here. But we can get you the steward, Paul. He's incompetent, I have to say. But he can do a mojito, a rum and coke, a dark and stormy, the captain's secret coconut and pineapple mocktail, or a straight shot.
I think it's going to be a mojito.
Good lad.
Yeah.
Lots of vitamins, bit of mint.
Yeah, it's clearly a health drink. Yeah. Yeah.
We'll get that sorted. That'll be dropped off in a second. So, Chris, so much has been written about your sporting career, all of the things that you've done on a bike and now obviously in cars, but I'm not interested in that. It's been written before and it's all brilliant. And we've met before in years gone by. I know you're a big sports fan growing up in Scotland. What are your earliest memories as a young lad? I think you're an Edinburgh lad, aren't you?
Edinburgh lad, yeah. My earliest sporting memories, I guess it was the first time I really, really cared about sport, I think, was I was about 8 or 9, and Hearts, my local football team, were doing really well in the league. And they were, I think, like 5 or 6 points clear at Christmas. It was for the first time in my lifetime, a non-Old Firm team were looking like they were going to win the league. And it was just very exciting. So inevitably, you know, the fever pitch builds, you get closer and closer to the end of the season. And it came into a bit of a nail-biting finish. And on the final day, Hearts only had to get a draw, even if they lost. As long as Celtic didn't win by more than 3 goals, then they would win on goal difference. And of course, the inevitable happened. Hearts lost 2-0 to Dundee, and Celtic won 5-1 at St Mirren. So Hearts lost the league on goal difference. And I think I was about 8 at the time, it was absolutely heartbreaking. And I was listening to it on the radio, and it was just so, you know, unjust. It was like, but this can't, you know, this isn't fair.
It's not fair.
This isn't fair. And my dad's saying, yeah, well, life's not fair. And, you know, sport is exciting.
Did that then sort of cement your love of Hearts?
It was the opposite, really. Because 2 weeks later in the cup final, so I thought, well, they've lost the league. We'll win the cup final. We're against Aberdeen. You know, we'll salvage something from this season. And of course, they lost the cup final as well.
Oh,
so they, instead of getting the double, they got nothing. And it broke my heart, and it almost put me off football. And I guess football or sport in general is about supporting teams that are mediocre at best and just suffering with them and learning to be faithful and loyal. I was the opposite. I basically I walked away from football.
But hang on, you went to Scottish rugby.
Well, yeah. Well, so then, yeah, true. So I guess it was just about the times. I played football at school at that age, and then I started playing rugby. Or rugby was offered, I think, from primary 6 onwards. So I was probably about 11 or 12, I think, when I first started playing rugby. And then I loved that. And, you know, rugby was my new passion, my new thing. So I guess football was replaced with rugby.
And did you have a rugby club that you supported?
Yes.
Or was it more the national team?
Yeah, the club. So I used to go and watch Watsonians at the weekend with my dad. Gavin Hastings and Scott Hastings were in the team. Gavin Hastings was my hero, you know, but both of them were my heroes. But it was, yeah, you go down and watch Watsonians.
So you were 11 or 12 when they were at their pomp?
I mean, I was 14 when they won the Grand Slam in 1990,
right,
which I missed. I was away racing BMX in Paris, and I had to listen to it on the radio again. I was gutted to miss it because I used to go down to all the Five Nations in those days, matches at Murrayfield, and you get the schoolboy enclosure tickets. And at the end of the match, you could run out onto the pitch and pat your hero on the back if you could reach them. And it was, yeah, rugby was my real sort of passion.
And did you, as a wee lad before you became Chris Hoyt, did you meet Gavin or Scott Hastings?
Well, Gavin actually came to our school or the rugby practice on a random Tuesday afternoon, and we didn't know anything was happening. We just, you know, normal day. And then out of, you know, the change rooms walks this giant of a man, big Gav comes out, and everybody was stunned. And he came over and said hello and gave us a quick chat and basically said, you know, you all have the potential to make the Scottish team if you work hard enough. And you know, you gave that extra 10% in practice that day because big Gav was there watching you.
And it is astonishing, isn't it? And I'm sure it's something that you carried on into your own professional sports career. The impact that a hero can have on a child when they come to a school or a sports practice or whatever it is. I think sometimes one can forget quite how unbelievably it can change your mindset as a kid.
And just by being there, just by them seeing you, and it's, you know, just by bringing it to life, it was remarkable. Yeah, so Gavin was the kind of sporting hero in those days. And he was a great player too, you know, I mean, some of the...
And could you have been a good rugby player?
I wasn't great. I was reasonably tall at school, but just that kind of period where, you know, you're starting to grow, hitting your growth spurt, everybody else grew right before me. So I went from being fairly big in the team to being probably the second smallest. I played standoff and I was the kicker. And I used to just have this knack of picking out the biggest guys in the team, kicking the ball out straight into their arms, and they would run straight back at me. And I used to take some big hits. But you had to learn to work harder, to be tougher, to deal with that kind of...
But you enjoyed that whole team ethic of rugby.
Yeah, I loved rugby. It was great. I played for Lothian Schools, B team. I captained them when I was for under 15s. But I was never going to be a great rugby player. I loved playing the game, but I was never going to be that
and
good.
And at what point did cycling come into your life as a sort of replacement / then became going forward? What sort of age?
I was doing BMX racing. So I'd raced BMX from the age of 7 or 8 onwards. So I had cycling going at the same time. I had rugby.
So you were fit.
I just love sport. Yeah. And it wasn't like I was the kind of kid you'd pick out and go, he's going to be really good at, you know, cycling or rugby or whatever later on in his life. But I just loved doing it. And I did rowing and a bit of running and other things too.
Anything to compete, really.
Exactly.
You went to Murrayfield, you say you went to that wonderful old schoolboys enclosure, which was magnificent. But who took you to early games of sport in general? Was it family? Did you go with friends?
My dad certainly to the kind of the club rugby, and then it was friends. So once you got to the age where it was only a 10-minute walk from our house down to Murrayfield. So, you know, it was seen as a relatively safe thing for kids to go and watch and. You know, go by themselves. So we'd get maybe five or six mates. They'd come round to our house. We'd have lunch. We'd have pie and beans, and then head down to watch the match. And then the crowds, you know, basically walk past the bottom of our street. So you couldn't drive anywhere. You couldn't go anywhere when the internationals were on. Still the same thing now. My parents still live in the same house.
And do you go to Scotland internationals when you can?
When I can, yeah. The last one was probably 2 or 3 years ago, but I got to go out on the pitch. I got to take the match ball out, actually, against fantastic. The All Blacks after Beijing Olympics. So it was the Autumn Internationals after, so it'd be 2008.
That must have been an extraordinary honour for the little boy inside you.
Oh, amazing. It was almost like all this sort of cycling nonsense has been worth it, just so I can go out with a Scotland. They gave me a Scotland jersey with number, I think it was number 3 in the back for the 3 gold medals. And I sort of planted the ball down in the middle just after the All Blacks had done the haka. So it was a kind of, to try and diffuse their impact was bring someone on, distract the crowd, you know, get a big cheer and deflect from what they'd just done. And I was so pumped up. I was absolutely buzzing. I think it was more buzzing than the Scotland players were.
So you were very close to seeing what the haka looked like.
Yeah.
What was that like, seeing it much closer than being in the stands, just standing on the touchline before you went on?
It's you can feel it in the air. It's weird. It's like an electric thing that, you know, you go out there and it's you know, to think that you've got to stand there and face that. And it's not just the haka, it's everything it represents. It's the players. It's just this challenge, isn't it?
Did you have any of that? I mean, not many sports or teams have something like the haka, but that what the haka seems to be is an extraordinary, it condenses the All Blacks into this fighting spirit.
Hmm.
In cycling, is it anything like that? Because it's, again, such a physical sport, or is it more just quiet preparation, getting ready?
I think different athletes are, you know, have different approaches. But for me in cycling, I used to love it when one of my rivals would start trying to eyeball me or trying to psych me out or growling or, you know, bumping into you when you're walking up.
And would that happen?
Occasionally, yeah.
Really?
But I thought, well, great, because it's a sign that he's scared of me. If he's gone out of his way to actively try and psych me out, it's because he's terrified that he thinks he needs to do it. Yeah.
If he ignored you, he might not be. Yeah.
Because, you know, for me, I was like, well, that's great. If he's taken that trouble to try and distract me, then he must be worrying about me.
So you travelled all over the world with cycling, obviously. And as a fan watching sport, and I think I know the answer, but where's your favourite place? As a fan, not to perform in a velodrome, where have you been that you've gone, this is...
I mean, Murrayfield is kind of like the home of Scottish rugby, obviously, and it brings memories from your childhood. And, you know, I've been to some amazing, amazing places around the world to compete in. And I've been as a spectator to some amazing places, Wimbledon, Centre Court. I've been to, I watched the Australian Open final, Andy Murray against Federer back in 2011. Can't remember when that was. I was in Perth training and Andy was doing well, obviously, and progressing. And I was getting messages back and forth. And basically, the message was, if you want a ticket, come across and watch the match. And I was like, well, I'll tell you what, I'll come if you make the final, I'll come over, thinking, you know, it's a training camp. I really should be focused on what I'm doing here. And he made the final.
Is he a good friend? Has he become someone you've got to know?
I wouldn't say good friend, as in, you know, he's not the sort of person I'll be chatting to on the phone once a week. But you know, I see.
Are you contemporaries?
I don't know how.
I can't remember how old he
is. He's a bit younger than me. But no, I've only met him face-to-face a handful of times, but he's the kind of person you feel you know well because I know his mum, Judy, pretty well as well. And you know, and Jamie I've met many times too. So,
wonderful. I mean, you've all been great ambassadors for Scottish sports the last few years.
Andy's done so well. And I think he's battled against this image that the media kind of pigeonholed him into. And in reality, he's a really funny guy. He really got a great sense of humour. I went to one of his, it was his charity fundraising dinner And it was brilliant. They had Rob Brydon there, who basically mercilessly mocked him and did impressions of him. And he joined in and, you know, he loved it all. And he's a really good guy.
And you're obviously a competitive person. You've already explained that. Do you like watching sport best at home? Do you like being live at an event? Are you someone who likes to just focus on the telly and have silence from the family so you can focus?
It's funny because if you go, like, for Formula One, as an example, I'm a motorsport fan. I'd much rather watch it on TV to get all the commentary, the data, the information. You get a much better experience of the race itself if you're watching on TV. But there's nothing like being at any sporting event live. You get a whole different appreciation for what the athletes are doing, for the atmosphere. Just the emotion of it is on another level when it's live. And yet it's almost better to watch it on TV for the actual performance.
Well, I was going to ask you that. There is great emotion, and some people find sport very emotional. As a fan, have you cried ever watching sport? Many times.
Yeah, I definitely cried aged 8 or 9, whatever it was, in the beginning. It has a massive emotional impact on me when I watch. I mean, even last week I was out in Berlin for the Laureus Awards, and there's these incredible stories, as well as the sports person of the year. There's also overcoming adversity, and there's breakthrough moments. And I remember there was a guy, Dan Jensen was a speed skater in the States years ago, and I didn't actually see it when it happened, but in years, you know, at subsequent time, I watched these videos and learned about his story. And he was the world champion, and he missed out on the Olympics and crashed, and then he tried again, and he just kept failing and failing at the Olympics, and it was his dream to become Olympic champion. And then I think his sister died the day before his final chance to win Olympic gold, and it was the event that he wasn't the favourite in, and he'd fouled up in the one that he was favourite, and he went out and he won the gold medal. And it was just this, you know, I've told it in a really rubbish way, but I think it's on YouTube. If you go and check it on there, it is such an emotional story. And then the moment of that moment when he crosses the line, he looks up at the sky, obviously to his sister, and you've got to be made of stone not to have a bit of a wobble when you watch that.
And from that, this is the question I like more than anyone, which tells you something about my girth, which is, you're at Murrayfield, you're with your mates, Scotland are playing, they're about to beat England, we can dream.
Of course.
And it's half time, and you allowed a bit of sin food.
Yep.
So you've got all those vans behind. What does Chris Hoy, when he's not worrying about training and keeping yourself fit, what is it?
Do you know what? Anything at all. I'm doing Saturday Kitchen in a few weeks' time, and you've got to choose food hell, food heaven. You know, what's your favourite food? What's the food you just hate? Food heaven, easy. You know, there's so many things I could choose from, but food hell, I genuinely don't have anything that I can think of that I don't like to eat, as long as it's the food's
good
fresh.
Pie,
a good pie, love pizza, love burgers, love fish and chips, whatever's probably stuff that's easier to eat.
In your hand.
But a nice pie, I think that would be.
Yeah, we can get that done, I'm sure.
Excellent.
And a fan song, fan anthem. I mean, are you a Flower of Scotland fan?
It just brings such emotion it brings back memories of childhoods and in the terraces and just that, you know, that. Yeah.
Well, I always think I was lucky enough for in a former life when Captain Morgan rum was not in my life, famous Grouse whiskey was.
Yeah.
And I remember you had the North British Distillery, which is just over the road, over the train line.
That's
there.
Right, yeah.
But it brings over that smell, which is very unique to Murrayfield and then the pipes.
That's right.
I mean, I'm Welsh, but I nearly supported Scotland on several occasions. So here we are, you're sort of cycling career's over. You're in motor racing now. You've travelled around the world. You've got your business of your bikes. All the things going on. You travel a lot. What event have you not been to, or events have you not been to that are on your own bucket list in sport that you would just love to go to as a punter?
That's a great question. I've been so fortunate. I've been to Formula One around the world in various places. I've been to, as I say, Wimbledon. I don't know. I think this is a tough one.
Been to a Super Bowl?
Super Bowl would be amazing. I think American sports. I'll tell you what, one sport that I did go to that I didn't expect to be quite as exciting or quite as much fun was an Aussie rules game.
Where did you go?
It was in Perth at the Subiaco Oval.
Yeah.
And it was even just a pre-season friendly. inverted commas, friendly. You know, it was absolutely fierce, a fierce match. But the way the fans were just so into it, they're so tribal. And the athleticism of the players as well. It's a really tough sport.
And don't you find, I've been to Australia, lucky enough to be down there and to watch it. I'd never seen, I think we used to get it on British television, but you just see it within the tight camera arc.
Yeah.
When you see the whole oval, you see the extraordinary running off the ball that the fellas are doing.
And it's huge. It's huge, the pitch as well. So I think, grand final.
At the MCG.
Would be awesome, yeah.
Yeah, I think we can probably arrange that as well. We'll see what we can do. And I'm sure, again, through your Olympics, and I mean, you are considered an Olympic legend yourself, but is there a sporting hero that you would love to have met or would like to meet that just stands out that you'd like to...
I met him once, and he was one of my heroes, my all-time heroes, Colin McRae. So he died in a helicopter crash in 2007, tragically, with his son and a friend and his friend's son. It was awful. But I met him only once, just for probably about 2 minutes, about a year before his accident. And I was absolutely just starstruck because he was, you know, he is an absolute legend. And you think about, he won the World Championship in 1995, you know, only one world championship versus guys like Loeb, who've won it many times, or other drivers. But the impact he's had with that one victory and his driving style, his commitment, he's got way more fans now than almost any other rally driver in history. It's incredible. You go to events and they'll be there with their blue Imprezas and they'll be waving the Colin McRae flags. So, I would love to have met Colin for more than 5 minutes and to have... to got to know him. I know his father really well, Jimmy. I did a documentary about Colin's life for BBC back in 2013 and got to drive his cars and sort of finished the programme with the reenacting the final stage of Rally GB where he won the world title. I got to drive his car with his co-driver, Derek Ringer. So that was a huge honour. But really, really emotional as well. And the first time the family had really opened up to the media after his death. So a very poignant and quite a tricky thing to do as well.
And you mentioned the Laureus Sports Awards, where the great and the good from many sports, they just had their awards ceremony there. Presumably that must be, for all of you, I would imagine, for the sportsmen and women who are there, a little bit where everyone's sort of pointing at different legends. It must be quite a thing.
It's amazing. So the awards are the big showcase event, but they have an academy of ex-athletes. So when you retire, and if you've achieved a certain level in your sport, you get invited to join the academy. And there's now 68 members or 69 members, I think, in the Laureus Academy. And I got asked to join 4 or 5 years ago, and it was just mind-blowing. You go in the very first time into the meeting, this AGM, and you sit down and you look around the room, and it is like a who's who of your childhood sporting heroes. Boris Becker, Martina Navratilova, Nadia Comaneci, Ed Moses, Michael Johnson, Daley Thompson, Steve Redgrave, unbelievable. And it's what's weird is that they know your name and you're chatting to them as if it's the most normal thing in the world.
There must be a temptation that you want to take selfies with everybody, but you can't because you want to look like this is every day.
even like Tony Hawk. Tony Hawk was, I was a skateboarder when I was a teenager, and he's part of it now. And you're like, this is absolutely bizarre. You know, I was chatting to Mark Spitz for about 2 hours over dinner last week, and you're just thinking, this is the strangest thing to be at this event and to meet these absolute heroes.
Amazing. Now, Chris, we come to the part of the show which I call the captain's broadside, which is because I'm going to ask you a series of not really quick fire questions, but just quite random questions, and we'll just sort of see how we go. And the first thing is that you've come aboard my beautiful 16th, 17th. Mm. Well, I keep changing the century. So for the record, this is an 18th century pirate ship, I think.
Okay.
And it's called the Reeve Gauche. So.
Excellent.
And it's pretty seaworthy. I say that a little bit tentatively, a few holes.
I can see a leak down there.
And a couple of wormholes, which I'm not sure about. But we can try, go back to the coast and sail anywhere in the world that your heart desires. Where would it be?
I think looking out across this clearly miserable grey day, I'd love to be in Australia right now, because we used to go to Perth, Western Australia, every year to train in the winter. So it'd be our off-season training camp. And of course, I appreciated it at the time, but I think it's only since I've retired and I've had to face a British winter without any kind of, escapes away to the sunshine, that I really do miss that.
That's one of your happy places.
So many great memories there. It was tough. I mean, it was, that was where you lay the foundation for the year ahead. But it was such a fantastic place. We got to know loads of people there. You know, it was a home from home for 2 months of the year.
Wonderful. And of course, now that you're training a little bit less than you were when you were cycling, you can enjoy Margaret River wine.
Lovely. Mosswood, down Mosswood, and yeah, wine tours, fantastic.
Well, we're keeping that culinary thing going. But on our first night, as we go down, towards Australia, it's going to be a long journey. We may bore each other to death, so I'll give you some back catalogs of this podcast. that'll help you sleep. We've got this beautiful oak table that you can see in the galley here, and we're going to give you one night where you get to choose the menu. Mm-hmm. Now, because I'm a lover of cheese, you get a cheese course from the captain. That's just how it is.
Yeah.
But your three-course meal, what is it?
Three-course meal. Three-course meal. I think I had a beautiful meal recently at The Kitchen in Edinburgh. So Tom Kitchen is Michelin star chef. I think he's got 2 Michelin stars. Amazing guy, works incredibly hard. For somebody who, you know, is at the top of his game, you could imagine that he might not be at the restaurant 7 days a week. Every time I've been there, every time you pop in, he's there. He's the reason it's a success is because he works so hard. And I had an amazing, you always have an amazing meal there, but I would go for what we had last time. Scallops for starter, these Orkney ones that he's got a specific guy who dives and gets these amazing, huge, big lumps of just sheer joy. and he actually, I did a little cooking course with Tom years ago, and him showing me what to do. That was one of his sort of, you know, it's a simple thing to do, apparently. And I tried it and cooked it, and it was amazing. So scallops to start, some nice Wagyu beef. I've got a friend who's got a Wagyu business. Basically, he's got these cattle up in Scotland, Highland Wagyu, it's called, and they just by far the best beef I've ever tasted.
And you're having chops with that,
of course,
of course,
chops. But yeah, maybe surf and turf. So maybe some Wagyu and maybe a langoustine or a bit of lobster or something with that. And then the final pudding. Sticky toffee pudding, I think. That would be nice.
It'll be delicious. And
we'll deep fried Mars bar. Do you know, I've got a thing about deep fried Mars.
Any cliche.
Because Scotland, it gets such a bad rep. And the food that we have in Scotland is amazing. There's so much fresh produce. And it's, and then people only ever mention the deep fried Mars bars.
But, I know, it's wrong. Mind. It's all wrong. Yeah. Okay, so once you've digested that, you get a really nice cabin. Mm-hmm. And again, we're in, what did I say, 17th, 18th century?
18th, I think it 18th was last
century.
Time, yeah.
Oh, whatever we're in a century. But we've got a power shower. That's important.
Oh, excellent. Yeah.
You want to keep you. Fresh. Yeah. What song does Chris Hoy sing in the shower? And do you have a good voice?
I don't have a good voice. I had to do, I got conned into doing an advert for Visit Scotland years ago, and they said, oh, everyone's doing it. You've got, you know, Sean Connery's doing it, and Lulu, and, you know, you've got to, you know.
Is that right?
It doesn't matter if you can't sing, because we've got, you know, all this technology that'll make you sound fine. I was like, really? But I really can't sing that. No, I'll be fine. And Sean didn't sing. He just spoke his line. Everybody else was like proper singers, and I had this. It was Caledonia. So, you know, I wouldn't sing it, obviously. But
Feel free.
And it's ruined the song for me. It's a lovely song. And every time I think of it now, I cringe, because it was just this one line of me. And I wasn't allowed to wear Olympic kit, but they want me to be in some sort of sporting kit. So someone ran off to like a JJB Sports and bought this blue tracksuit. I looked like I was... it was just the weirdest thing, you know. I look back now and think, God, you make some mistakes.
So you're not going to ruin the cruise there? You're not going to sing in the shower?
I'm not going to. I'm going to be singing quietly to myself, yeah.
Okay, and do you remember what your first album was that you bought?
First album?
CD, whatever.
I'll tell you, the very first album I remember was Laughing Policeman, and it was this sort of comedy as a kid. I didn't buy it myself, but the first thing I remember having that was music-related, and it was a whole host of songs. There was a Laughing Policeman. There was Right Said Fred, not as in the band, but was it Terry Scott?
I think it was.
And there was Goodness Gracious Me and all these sort
of... On a vinyl,
yeah.
Yeah.
But the first music, I think, was Dire Straits' Brothers in Arms.
Album, very strong.
Yeah, cassette that was.
Yeah, we had cassettes. I don't think children know what cassettes are now. No. They look at them peculiarly. And do you remember your first album? Your first concert that you went to?
First concert.
And where?
I think it was, I didn't go, because it was my first concert. The first one I can remember now was Moby, I think, in Edinburgh at New Year, probably the late 90s.
Because you get a lot of great, I mean, because you got the festival as well. Yeah, I mean, live yeah. is a big part of the yeah, Edinburgh
absolutely.
Scene.
Absolutely. I think that was the first one. Can't really remember, but yeah.
It's pretty good.
Mobile. And the power went down halfway yeah. through. The whole thing went black, darkness.
Oh, wow.
It shut down for, and then they restarted it, and then it went down again. And then they finally managed to fix the generator or whatever.
Or they put some coins in the meter. And do you remember your first car?
Oh, yes, of course. My first car was a Citroen Xantia diesel. It's my parents' old car, 130,000 miles on the clock when I inherited it.
And you loved it very much, I
suspect. I hated it. I hated it because it kept breaking down on me. So I was using it. The only reason I got a car in the only reason I passed my test was because I had to get from Edinburgh at home down to Manchester to the track, to the velodrome. And there were training camps or training weekends every second weekend. And it was before lottery funding. You got the only money we ever got was we got like about 5 pence per mile as a contribution towards our travel. So I would often go down with Craig McLean's, sort of share the costs. And it had this air suspension that kept just dropping, you know, with no warning at all in the motorway. And all of a sudden you start bouncing along. So you've got to try and adjust it and either jack up like you were on a monster truck or back down too low again. It was the days before mobile phones, so you would be looking at the emergency telephones at the side of the motorway and clocking, right, okay, I've just gone past that one now. So if I break down, it's quicker to walk back than it is to walk forwards. So, yeah, anyway, I got to Manchester.
You got to Manchester, and you've now had some nicer cars since in
yes.
your own love of car. That's,
yeah.
So that's probably your greatest triumph, in
yeah.
a sense.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, decent car. And we're about to have to get you walking across the gangway and head on our way. If we could smuggle your most treasured possession, not a person or a dog or anything like that, but just something that you've got. Is there something that, because it's a pirate ship, we can smuggle? We've got all sorts of nooks and crannies and treasure chests. I mean,
I don't know. In terms of an object, the easy answer would be an Olympic medal, a gold medal. But I guess the gold medals, they're just a lump of metal and a bit of ribbon. You know, they don't actually mean anything. It's what they represent. And it's the memories that are the most important thing. And I think that's when you see athletes that are retrospectively awarded medals for, you know, someone's beaten them when they've been caught for doping, and they go, well, you've got your medal, that's all right, you're Olympic champion now. To me, it's all about the experience and the moment, and you can never get that back, which is that's just the worst thing about people that have cheated their way to the top and taken that experience away from someone else.
And you've always been very vocal about that—the zero tolerance in any sport.
Absolutely, because it's otherwise, well, what's the point in doing it? You know, and what satisfaction could you gain from winning by cheating? By knowing that you're cheating, not by, you know, there's a difference between, you know, pushing your luck in a game or trying to, you know, in terms of, I don't know, a sporting game or trying to push the rules or trying to hopefully the referee not seeing what you're doing on the pitch. But it's actively going out there and thinking, right, I'm going to, you know, put something in my body that's going to give me an advantage. You think, well, where is the joy in that?
Well, I think, I mean, you're a fine man, and it's been shown to me that the parrot Leanne, who's sitting behind you, doesn't always like Celts. She has a dislike of Welsh people.
I've discovered.
Oh, but she's been sitting very quietly and very peacefully. So I'm delighted that you haven't been pecked, because that would be a nightmare. Chris, we could talk for hours, but we've got hours because we're sailing to Perth.
Yes.
So I'm going to let you get your bags into your cabin, etc., and then we'll get ready for the delicious supper ahead. It has been such a pleasure to have you on board the Reeve Gauche and for you to take time to come and chat to me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Captain. The pleasure was all mine.
So there we have it. Sir Chris Hoy, British cycling royalty, on my own boat. Amazing. And a real joy and pleasure to have him on board this week. I suspect he's going to take some feeding. I think the galley are going to be working overtime. He still looks terrifyingly fit. And all the way through our chat, I was sucking in my stomach, trying to sort of be his equal. And unfortunately, a couple of my buttons popped off my waistcoat, which is slightly embarrassing. My next guest, in a couple of weeks' time, is a proud Englishman with Irish and Italian blood who is also known to don lycra every year for his own charity foundation. Laurence Dallaglio, former England World Cup winner, now businessman and media pundit, will be coming on the Reeve Gauche, and I suspect, like Sir Chris, he's going to require an awful lot of feeding. Until then, I'd be very grateful if you could subscribe to Are You Not Entertained, to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Podbean. If you've got feedback about the format of the show, whether you enjoyed it or whether if you don't, then you can find me on Twitter at GilesMorgan71. If you want to give me other constructive feedback, or you think there might be a company out there that is mad enough to sponsor the show, sort of companies like Ginsters, Captain Morgan Rum, those are the ones that are in my target, then please email me at giles@gilesdmorgan.com. I pay a very generous commission to be negotiated. If you want to suggest another guest, or you've just got some thoughts on the show, then email me at giles@gilesdmorgan.com. So join me in a couple of weeks' time for the Captain's Table with Lawrence Dallaglio. And until then, keep your sails trimmed and your bow pointing straight. Thank you.